Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, the Democrats are in Detroit for the next 2 days for round two of the debates. 20 candidates are sharpening memorable lines and crafting strategies for injecting themselves into the conversation as they prepare for round two of Democratic presidential debate. For a sense of where we are with the first of two nights, we turn to my first guest. He's the producer of By Any Means Necessary, and he's on the ground in Detroit from the Fox Theater, Bob Schlehuber. Bob, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Hey, nice to be back.
So we're just a few hours from the beginning or round two of the Democratic hopefuls. What's the vibe on the street right now in Detroit?
You know, I was actually spent my morning here in Flint, heading back to Detroit. Now Flint is the backdrop that I wanted to focus on to this first debate here in Detroit, talking to people there about the ongoing water crisis that is still yet to be resolved. Basically thinking that that's going to be one of the biggest issues brought up tonight. What do you do with Flint? And talking to people there, people are ready to see what Democrats have to say. I think a lot of faith and trust have been lost in that party going back to the end of Obama's administration when he said there was no Flint water crisis anymore and that people could pack up their bags. The National Guard left. They said, water, good to go. Go ahead and drink it. I'm going to drink it in front of you here. And everybody said, wait a second. We still have thousands of people in the city that aren't able to gain access to clean water on a daily basis. So people are looking for answers on what he's going to do with Flint, as well as address the issues of poverty across the country. It was really striking asking people, what do they want to hear when Flint gets brought up tonight? And they said, you know, you can tell a person's just talking a lot. They said the problem only exists in Flint. These people understand that Detroit has had problems with issues of poverty across the board that need to be addressed. Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Los Angeles, Baltimore, and throughout, looking for those broader conversations. So issues around poverty will be on the forefront of people's minds tonight. And obviously a little bit of an interesting night here, as none of the candidates tonight, due to the draw, are people of color. It's all white candidates. And so it'll be an issue, interesting point when the issues of race get brought up.
You're taking me right to my second question. Are they playing to the House? Are they playing to the country? Or both? Greg Palast's research, notwithstanding, where he found Michigan officials declared in late November that Trump won the state by 10,704 votes, but there were 75,355 that weren't counted. I go to that to say Trump won Michigan, but did he really? And the number says that he didn't. So my question is, with the Democrats needing Michigan, do you expect questions that matter to local viewers, such as the Flint water crisis and whether or not to bail out Detroit schools, that are local issues that have national resonance? And also, what about the economy and jobs and healthcare in what has become an incredibly deindustrialized state, as the big three automakers were there but losing jobs? So elaborate a little more on, are they going to play to the House or are they going to play to the country?
Yeah, and the question, adding to some of the math there for your listeners, it was 100,000 votes Clinton lost from what Barack Obama was able to garner in Wayne County, where Detroit sits alone. Genesee, the county where Flint sits, another 100,000 more people voted for Barack Obama than Hillary Clinton. That's 200,000 people that didn't show up or at least didn't consistently vote Democrat from Obama to Clinton. And that obviously pales in comparison to less than 11,000 votes that Clinton needed to have won Michigan. How do you get those people out there voting again? Was it Hillary Clinton that specifically was why people, I just talked to somebody, said, you know, between Hillary Clinton being a woman among some parts of the demographic, the transgressions of Bill Clinton, both in his personal as well as his policies, and Hillary Clinton's own policy positions on things, people said enough with her. So it'll be really interesting to see if it was Hillary Clinton that drove that vote so low for her in Michigan and the Democratic candidates just, you know, say the right things for people to hear tonight, or if something is missing when it comes to public trust within the Democratic Party and that needs to be healed. I can't imagine any of the issues that brought up tonight can't also be the same issues that we're going to see right now in Baltimore, in Detroit, in New York, amongst poor poor people as well as some people of color. So it seems like you can play to the house, but the nation as well as some of the fixes that need to take place here in Detroit are also plaguing major cities across America.
I know she didn't go to Wisconsin. Was Michigan another one of the states she didn't go to?
I think she was here, but much too late talking to people this morning. And I could be wrong on that, but the gentleman I just talked to, who is a paralegal, said it was well too late in the game that she came here when Trump was here in Michigan consistently.
Okay, she came, but she came very late in the game.
And Trump was here. You know, I mean, there's a guy saying, look, I'm a business guy. Let's try something different. And when people are saying, hey, well, I don't know about this Hillary Clinton. I know Hillary Clinton enough. Let's roll the dice. And people are in a roll the dice situation with Donald Trump. And then a few years of him and all of Donald Trump's brought to the White House. How do people even feel the need to participate in electoral politics when it's delivered them nothing from either side of the spectrum?
Very, very good point, Bob. Very good point. Bernie and Elizabeth Warren will be on the stage together this evening. Can they articulate policy and differentiate themselves from each other without attacking each other?
And do they want to? And that's the big question, is say, hey, maybe we stay in it together here. Let's support each other. Let's pick off some of these centrist candidates. Let's get the Tim Ryans, the Beto O'Rourke, some of these other candidates who are starting to trail and slip off. Let's attack them. And in September, November, plenty of time headed into Iowa for the two of us to differentiate ourselves. Let's stick close together. Or does CNN ask questions in a certain way? How do you get to, say, rid of private insurance? The two candidates have been very clear. They have different paths on how to get rid of private health insurers in the marketplace. So it'll be interesting to see if CNN forces them to articulate the difference between the two of them and if they take the bait or not. Obviously, issues around foreign policy would separate the two, and Bernie Sanders pushing the end to the U.S. support of the Yemen war, as well as Bernie Sanders working outside of the Democratic Party, his Our Revolution, his political organization that he launched after his failed attempt at running for president last time around. They were endorsing lefty candidates that were not Democrats going against Democrats. Elizabeth Warren has worked within the party. She endorsed some 80 candidates. Oh, excuse me. She only endorsed 5 candidates, playing it relatively safe not to shake things up, where Bernie Sanders had endorsed some 80 candidates last time around. So it'll be interesting. There are differences. I'm not sure if the general public know them yet. It'll be interesting to see if they play out tonight.
You know, thinking about the African-American population in Michigan, particularly in Detroit and in Flint, wondering if success for Bernie in Michigan could carry or help to generate some momentum for Bernie in South Carolina. Because a lot of people are saying, you know, Joe Biden just has an overwhelming margin of element of support with African-Americans in South Carolina. So I wonder if Bernie could try to show some momentum and some warming by the African-American community towards him.
Yeah, and people seemingly were high on Bernie Sanders still. They question whether or not he'd be able to capture that kind of same momentum that he had in 2016, but they wanted to see where he goes tonight and afterwards, and that if he is able to strike that populist message again, calling for major economic reforms and taxes increases on the wealthiest 1% of the country, I think it resonates, and it could be the kind of like jumping off and catalyst point for him. Again, he does need to articulate his socialist messaging on how that contrasts with Elizabeth Warren wanting to fix markets or make markets more equitable. She is still a capitalist. So you're moving a lot of people away from some of their familiar language. And if he's able to move those people, I think it really captures the imagination. People are looking for something new. They've tried Democrat. They have a governor that's a Democrat now. They have two senators that are Democrats now. They see the results Democrats get them. It's constant chaos. It's constant fear. Is Bernie Sanders able to grab that, assuage people's fear, and then take them to the left along with his messaging?
Bob Schlaehuber, producer of By Any Means Necessary, thank you so much for your time, and look forward to talking with you tomorrow as well. We'll do some analysis of what transpires tonight.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Bob. Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Maria Butina's attorney says that feds withheld exculpatory information given by an FBI informant. A lawyer for Russian national Marina Butina who is accusing federal prosecutors of withholding exculpatory information about her that the CEO of a multi-billion-dollar company provided to the FBI. Robert Driscoll, Butina's lawyer, sent a letter last Thursday to the Justice Department requesting an investigation into possible misconduct by prosecutors and the FBI in handling information from Patrick Brine, the CEO of online retailer Overstock.com. How important and significant is this? For insight, we turn to my next guest. He is an international affairs and security analyst. He is Mark Sloboda. Mark, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Dr. Leon, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on the Critical Hour.
So in his letter, Driscoll said he asked prosecutors whether confidential informants had provided information about Butina. He also said he conveyed that he believed Brine was one of the informants. And Driscoll said that he raised the theory in a quest to obtain any exculpatory information that the government had. Prosecutors are required to provide exculpatory information known as Brady material to defendants. Quote, "My speculation was flatly denied," wrote Driscoll, who confirmed to the Daily Caller News Foundation that he sent the letter to the Justice Department. Your thoughts on the significance of this revelation?
Yeah, this is really going to, I think, cause some embarrassment and probably some heads to roll and will really damage the FBI in this, because this is coming from the person himself, Patrick Byrne, the CEO of the online retailer Overstock.com. He's come forward himself because he feels that the FBI has basically wrongly pursued their lawsuit against Maria Butina and has completely mischaracterized what she was doing in the United States. He says that she was really just a student activist, very interested in gun rights and promoting U.S.-Russian cooperation. And even we know here in Moscow that she was actually attempting to bring U.S. gun rights laws, something that aren't very looked on very kindly here in Russia, from the U.S. to Russia. So if anything, she may have been acting more as an influence of an American influence on Russian society than the other way around. But this CEO, Patrick Byrne, he was essentially an asset of the FBI. He was working for the FBI. They had a non-standard arrangement, and evidently they asked him to get close to Butina. They had originally met at a libertarian conference. He contacted them afterwards, and they wanted him to get close to her. In fact, he suggests that they actually encouraged him to have a sexual relationship with her, which is a supreme irony, because originally the FBI case against Maria Butina included a detail where it suggested that she had used sex to try to manipulate people to gain access and information. Now it looks like the exact opposite have been true. The FBI may have been using sex on her in order to compromise her. But the CEO eventually came forward, and he says that he thinks that this is really a misjustice, and he's passed this information on to Maria Butina's lawyer, and now he's hot on the FBI. And if they did withheld this information, as it seems fairly obvious right now, then it's going to cause a lot of problems for the FBI, and their charges against Butina are going to fall apart.
That's an interesting point, because she's currently in prison, and I think she's due to be released in October. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's correct. October, yes.
So it's also very interesting to me how, as you mentioned, the story originally unfolded and she was described as this Russian agent or operative who was using sex to coerce information out of, silly, easily duped Americans, because they were playing, in my opinion, playing to a standard trope or stereotype that Americans have of Russian female spies. And now, to your point, the irony here is that the script might have actually been flipped, and the FBI may have actually been the ones to introduce that whole idea into this. And final point, and then I'll let you respond, is that also what seems interesting here in terms of Patrick Brine is that he seems to be a guy with a conscience that is saying, I don't want to be a part of any type of operation, illicit operation, that is based upon lies and misleading information.
Yeah, well, maybe he has a conscience, maybe perhaps a bit too late, because he did engage in a, he says, a romantic, I think we can assume, sexual relationship with her at the instigation of the FBI. And then they asked, that fell apart eventually, and the FBI then asked him to reestablish a relationship with her a time later. And that is when he started to have some doubts. And it is now only after she has been in prison, in custody for more than a year at this point. I mean, she was sentenced for 18 months with time served. And she's due to get out in October, but she's already been, essentially in U.S. government custody for over a year. So I have to say that, you know, it's great that he's coming forward now and
right.
all.
Sure.
But a lot of this could have been avoided if she had come forward, before she had served a year under U.S. authorities' loving care.
This is an aside, but I think it is kind of tangentially related. Again, we had the image of her as being this spy, and now Brian is saying, no, she was just a student, as she claimed she was, and that it was Western intelligence that injected this whole thing. This really seems to be similar to what is now unraveling with the Mueller report, as Republican members of the Intelligence Committee are asking, well, who are these alleged Russian and people with Russian contacts that were bringing in these voter hacking stories? And now they seem to be Western operatives.
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I think we have to make clear that despite the salacious headlines across the mainstream media, even the FBI's charges against Maria Butina, what she was convicted on, what she agreed to in a plea deal after months in solitary confinement, she says she was pressured, is not that she was a spy, not that
Correct.
She was an agent, not that espionage, simply that she didn't register as a lobbyist
Correct.
Under the Foreign Registration Act. So that's important. But yeah, I think this really goes to if this could really shine a light into how the FBI is pursuing not only this case, but others, including the Mueller investigation, and that they may be going completely off the books in some quite murky territory in some type of neo-McCarthyite witch hunt. If what, this Butina case, if this proves to be true, I think it's probably very reflective of what they've also been pursuing in that investigation.
And people in this country that are listening to this conversation need to understand that we're not that far away. If they're doing this in instances such as this with Marina Butina, hey, folks, those of you who are listening, you may be next. It's not that big of a stretch. It's not that far of a leap.
Absolutely not.
Let's switch gears here to a second story, which we wanted to get your take on. Germany made no promises. Berlin rejects U.S. anti-Iran maritime coalition proposal. The United States has officially requested Germany, France, and the U.K. to join its military mission in the Gulf to combat what it purports to be Iranian aggression. Asked to comment on the U.S. offer, the German foreign minister told Sputnik that Berlin is not seriously considering the U.S. proposal. Mark, what does this mean for U.S. efforts to isolate Iran going forward?
Yeah, well, they're not dead yet. So the U.S. made a proposal. They're calling this Operation Sentinel, and they put forward a maritime patrol alliance, another type of coalition of the willing, if you will, in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz, they say, for freedom of navigation and protect shipping. And they included in it some very, shall we say, aggressive words, this maximum pressure campaign. And they referred to Iranian aggression, and the Germans balked at that. But the UK has put forward a solely European maritime patrol proposal. And now the US is pushing Germany to join that one. And a number of EU countries have already signed on to it. France, Italy, Denmark, I think I've heard Portugal and Poland as well. And there's a lot of pressure on Germany to join this one, although evidently there's a split in the German government. Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union is all for it, while the more left Social Democratic Party, which controls the foreign ministry, is saying, no, we don't want any part of this because it's going to end up in war with Iran. And we think we can solve this with diplomatic means. But I think another problem is that Germany really doesn't have any naval assets. They're stretched absolutely to the limit. They don't have a very large navy to begin with, certainly not blue water ships. And they would have to pull even one naval vessel to get even one naval vessel there, which really would only be a token contribution. They would have to pull it out of another mission that they're already involved in, either UN or a NATO operation in the Mediterranean. So they don't really have a lot of naval assets to contribute. It's more wanting Germany's political support. I think Germany is eventually going to agree to this. And the UK has already admitted that the EU's mission won't succeed without the US. And this is how, you know, all of these EU countries are going to get sucked into direct cooperation with the US as it drives towards conflict with Iran, with the UK playing the role of a bridge. And it's obvious that the European countries don't have the assets to, in any effective way, do real maritime patrol in that area. They will need the U.S., but they do have bases there. The U.S. has the 5th Fleet based in Bahrain. France has a naval base in the United Arab Emirates, and Britain has a naval base in Oman. So they're all situated with bases to, you know, provide supplies, logistics, base of operations to get this on their way. What they need are ships. Britain right now has, they just brought a second naval ship into the area. France will likely be doing so as well. And like I said, what they really need from Germany is political support to bring in more EU countries in on this, so it looks like a joint political effort. But regardless, I think it's going to happen. Germany's going to join this. Once the EU countries are all involved with this, they will inevitably be tied in with the U.S. there in their maritime patrols. And when the U.S., if it enters into a conflict with Iran, then the EU countries are going to get dragged into that conflict as well. Kicking and screaming, maybe, but they will regardless.
And you just, I think, addressed what my next question was going to be, and that is, is the U.S. anti-Iran maritime coalition and the EU maritime operation really distinctions without a difference?
Yes, yes. The EU mission cannot effectively operate there without already some degree of cooperation, intelligence sharing, command and control from the United States, even if they're claiming that they're there under a separate political policy, it will end up being the same mission. The EU just doesn't have the military forces to operate on its own without the United States. We saw this very well in Libya, where Obama tried to push the European countries into taking the lead into overthrowing Gaddafi, and they couldn't succeed until the U.S. stepped to the front and began taking a more leading role.
And what is Iran's response to this, at least up to this point?
Yeah, well, of course, they're saying, obviously, this isn't needed. that actually the instability in the region is being caused by the United States to begin with, and that they do not obviously want any foreign countries, you know, countries who aren't literal countries of the Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz to be there with any type of coalition of naval forces, which was, you know, is bound to only increase tensions and create possibilities for conflict to break out, you know, because of mistakes or, you know, intentionally with false flags and so on. Iran is also, as a measure of trying to combat this, is drawing closer to Russia. And the Iranian and the Russian military forces just in the last couple of days signed a new memorandum of understanding. And they said that naval exercises, Russian-Iranian naval exercises, will be quickly coming. And the head of the Iranian Navy suggested that those exercises could be in the Gulf of Hormuz, in the Straits of Hormuz. I haven't seen any confirmation of that from the Russian government, but that would put Russian ships into the Gulf as well. And that is increasing the possibilities for tensions with all these multiple players and blocks forming. Instability.
We're not talking about all of these ships and these operations taking place in the Atlantic or the Pacific Ocean. I mean, we're talking about a fairly small space in which these folks are operating, and that just increases or heightens the possibility of tension and conflict.
Yeah, I mean, the Persian Gulf into the Strait of Hormuz, right? That's a larger area. And it does have a lot of traffic. And it is impossible to see how even the U.S. Navy, with a bunch of European allies, can really effectively patrol. They can't accompany every ship that goes through there. A fifth of the world's oil goes right through there every day. But in particular, there's different choke points. And the Strait of Hormuz is one of these choke points where there's an extremely tight body of international water. It's very small. And on either side of it, of course, is Iranian territorial waters, the territorial waters of Oman. And in that tight little area, the potential for conflict is quite high because the U.S. has already established the precedent in there that they say that if any drone, and we can assume that this will eventually come to mean not only drones, but Iranian boats or possibly even aircraft get close to one of their ships,
right,
they reserve the fire to take it out. They've already done that. They claim they've done that with an Iranian drone already.
Right.
And the United States, of course, is on the other side of the world. It's not a littoral state to the Persian Gulf or the Strait of Hormuz. And to be involved in this way and invoking that kind of security privileges is a recipe for conflict.
Mark Sloboda, as always, thanks for your time. Thanks for your analysis. Greatly appreciate your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Is the DCCC in quote-unquote complete chaos as uproar over diversity intensifies? Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee Chairwoman Sherry Bustos, Democrat from Illinois, was set to make an unplanned trip to Washington from her district yesterday amid an outcry from top African-American and Latino lawmakers over a lack of diversity in the campaign arm's senior management ranks. Aides and lawmakers are calling for systematic changes to the DCCC, the party's main election organ. How much of a problem does this provide for the Democratic Party going forward? And are they falling victim to the very same issues that seemed to plague them in the last election. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She is communication specialist for In the Public Eye Communications, Joya Jefferson Neary. Joya, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on again.
In the last election, there was a lot of complaint about the failure of the DCCC to reach out to the African-American community, to have spends in African-American media, to hire African-American consultants. At the same time, when the party is clearly recognizes that its chances of success diminish with a diminished African-American participation. So your thoughts on this story?
I think that this is indicative of a lot of things that are going on in the Democratic Party, not just here, but historically. The Democratic Party has a reputation for ignoring African-Americans until, or Latino voters, until it's election time. So when you're putting together the staff of the Democratic committee that is raising money and recruiting candidates, the fact that you wouldn't think you would have to have a lot of Black input in order to do that, or people of color input, in order to successfully do that across the country is mind-boggling. Because how would you do it? For me, it feels like when H&M did that T-shirt with a monkey on it and decided to advertise it with a young Black boy, you know, the greatest monkey in the jungle, that nobody at the table making the decisions was Black. There wasn't an African descendant person or a Spanish descendant person in the room, because that level of insensitivity would have raised the hairs on their neck, we would hope. So if the DCCC isn't seeing that if you don't run more Black candidates, if you don't run more Latino candidates, and you don't have input from those communities to say who, how, and what the word is on the street in those communities, says that, you know what, you're just running another boys' club.
You are a communication specialist, and one of the problems that I have seen and that I have talked about with the Democratic Party for a number of years is messaging. As a communication specialist, do you hear or see issues along the messaging front that if the interests and concerns of Black and Latino lawmakers over a lack of diversity were actually addressed, the messaging would be better?
Yep.
Simple enough.
Yes.
Simple enough.
You know, it's interesting because I would tell you that the average American, let alone Black and Latino, but the average American is very, very concerned about the Mueller report, very, very concerned about Russian hacking. Not that it's not. But when I get up in the morning as a Black business owner or mother of a child or on my way to work or whatever, I am really worried about, am I going to bring in enough money to pay all the bills that are in front of me? Am I going to have enough financial stability to assure my family's future? Not just this generation, but generations to come. Can I build wealth? Am I going to be safe on the street from the police or my own? Those are the bread and butter issues that I think most people, no matter what race or your heritage, are waking up every morning and worrying about. And I don't know if politicians or the media are actually that concerned about what we're concerned about. So when I look at messaging, if Bernie Sanders is going to do this, or Kamala Harris is going to do this, or Donald Trump is going to do this, I actually want to know how you're going to do it. I don't want a stump speech. Tell me how you're going to do it, how it's going to get paid for, and what's the long-lasting effects of it. And I don't think either party are doing that for us, and neither is the media.
One of the things that I notice about Detroit debate that's taking place this evening and tomorrow, tonight, there are no people of color on the stage.
Yeah.
And now I understand how they did this allegedly randomly, and they just pulled names out of a hat. But I would think somebody would say, this is a bad optic. For Tuesday night, this is for the Democratic Party not having, and knowing that there are African-Americans in the mix, this is a bad optic.
It's a bad optic for the DCCC to have no black people, Latino people in its senior management. It's a bad optic for Congresswoman Bustos to come into the job and then replace people and replace all, some of those being people of color and replace that with all white people. It's a bad optic. But I don't think a lot of people who aren't black, who aren't Latino, are actually thinking about the optics.
Correct.
They're looking at, this is my guy, I want to have my guy with him. So what it takes to hire, to have a diverse population in your office, in your DCCC, in your party, is that somebody has to have, a large number of people have to have the consciousness to say, this doesn't look right. This can't be right.
What I still find amazing to me, there are some very powerful African Americans in the Democratic Party, Mignon Moore, Donna Brazile, Reverend Jesse Jackson. There are some very powerful people. No matter how powerful they are, they still don't seem to be able to hold sway over policy and messaging.
Because the attitude is, where are those black people going to go?
Well, Hillary Clinton found that out.
Yeah, well, let's just hope whoever in 2020 doesn't find that out.
Hillary Clinton, she knows the answer to that question. Joya Jefferson Nuri, thank you so much for your time. Greatly appreciate your insight and analysis and your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Immigration lawyers say Justice Department ruling could undercut thousands of asylum cases. A ruling from the U.S. Attorney General could upend the asylum claims of thousands of Central Americans and other asylum seekers who say they deserve protection in the United States because they belong to families that are victims of drug cartels or other criminals in their homelands. What does this mean going forward, and can the Attorney General make such proclamations? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He manages a solo practice dedicated exclusively to immigration law. He represents clients with complex family petitions, including VAWA applications, and litigates before the Executive Office for Immigration Review, as well as federal circuit courts. He represents asylum seekers before the Asylum Office and EOIR, as well as handles employment-based non-immigrant and immigrant visa petitions. He is attorney Mark Shmueli. Mark, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer.
So, Attorney General Barr issued the ruling yesterday, partially reversing a 2017 Board of Immigration Appeals decision in the asylum case of a Mexican national who said a drug cartel targeted him and his family. Barr said that just because members of ordinary families fall victim to, quote, private criminal activity, end quote, does not mean they can claim asylum protections in the United States on that basis. Mark, that to me flies directly in the face of long-standing not only United States law, but international law as well.
And that's absolutely right. It's a redefinition of the basic concept of what is a social group, a valid social group for asylum.
So Barr talks about genetic ties as well as families should be socially distinct. So he wrote genetic ties alone. What does that mean?
Yeah, that struck me too. I think in all of this, that really struck me. I mean, these are cases in which, and it needs to be said that three circuit courts have held that family ties are a valid social group, and no circuit court has sided with the interpretation of the Attorney General. So he has no basis other than his own, and three circuit courts who've gone the other way. So there's not even a split here. He's creating law. Now, beyond that, the use of genetic ties really makes it seem like, you know, you come up with people who are, you know, 175th part of a family, and it really feels tangential. When in reality, what these cases are very close-knit families in Latin America where, you know, everybody lives right near each other, if not in the same house. Somebody is in the case of this particular case, somebody is targeted in a protected class in that family. And other people, as they're looking for them, are targeted because of the relationship to the family, because somebody in the family refuses to join a political movement, opposes something, is an activist against the government. I mean, you think about the assassinations of family members around the world. Those people would no longer be protected under this. So what you're really talking in reality about is a family unit being left to this genetic connection terminology.
Well, this really, Mark, sounds to me more as though he's trying to look out for the interests of the wealthy. Because here's the paragraph. Barr wrote, genetic ties alone are insufficient to establish that a migrant is a member of a particular social group. He wrote that to qualify for protection, families should also be, quote unquote, socially distinct in some way, such as large and prominent clans that have been persecuted in some country. So what that says to me is when he talks about large and prominent, I'm thinking more of those in a social construct, those with means versus those without.
I think that's absolutely true. Particularly that's a really good point. But there's particularly when you're looking at indigenous groups in this hemisphere, and absolutely when you're talking about clans in Cameroon or ethnic groups, or sometimes called tribal groups in certain countries. Absolutely, that's true. However, there's the connection. It's so difficult to dissect, to separate the two of those, because so often you're not talking about huge groups of people, and the relationship is there with it as a family. So it's a really muddying of the waters intellectually. It's completely intellectually dishonest, but it's also, I think you're right, it's an attack on groups of people that remain vulnerable and do not have the ability to protect themselves.
He says, an asylum seeker's family should be distinct, quote, in the eyes of its society, not just those of its alleged persecutor. Again, I would think of prominent in whatever it is that makes one prominent. I'm thinking more generally in a financial construct. So it seems as though he's saying, if a drug cartel is going after your son because they want him in the gang and they're threatening your family because your son won't join, that's okay. But if your son is kidnapped because you're wealthy and they're holding him or your daughter for ransom, that's a whole different conversation.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And I also think when you're talking about people who the drug cartel is going after, they're going after people
for a myriad of reasons.
Yeah. And so people who are opposing the drug cartel and can't get the protection of the government for reasons they either can't or won't protect them are not going to be allowed to apply for asylum under this, because it's considered to be a crime, like if you're mugged on the street.
Mark, you're a brilliant attorney and you can address this much better than I. But in my understanding, dead is dead. Whether they kill your child because he won't join the gang, or whether they kidnap and kill your child because your family's wealthy, dead is dead.
Well, unfortunately, asylum laws require one of these five groups. So you need to be, you know, one of the five groups that
right.
are targeted. So you need to be targeted for a reason. So, you know, countries that are extremely violent, but you're just going to get where you risk being, you know, having street crime. You're not going to be targeted for any particular reason. Unfortunately, they can't qualify for asylum in almost any situation. But what's horrific about this is that the United States knows what's going on in these countries. They understand it, and They are specifically carving out reasons to deny the most vulnerable people who are being attacked because of their resistance or their inability to fight back against organized groups the government can't control, or in some cases the government itself. And that is what flies in the face of the groups that should be protected under asylum.
So we have just about a minute left. With that, and you said three circuit courts have already determined that what Barr is writing isn't accurate or correct. How do you see this shaking out? We got a minute.
I think it's going to, I think other circuits are going to probably rule quickly on these. I think, attorneys are going to fight. I think immigration judges are going to deny these cases wholesale. And I think it's going, we're going to find out what happens, because he does have the right. Now, he does go beyond having the right to just make a decision in this. So it could be enjoined. A court could enjoin, this decision, I suppose, because it's gone beyond his scope. But I think it's going to be decided in the circuits.
Okay.
We're hitting unprecedented ground, Wilmer, on so many of these things, it's really hard to tell.
Gotcha. I understand. Thank you. Attorney Mark Shmueli, S-H-M-U-E-L-I, S-H-M-U-E-L-I. This guy knows what he's doing. Give him a call if you need some help. Mark Shmueli, S-H-M-U-E-L-I. Thanks, Mark, for your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much, Wilmer. Take care.
All right, folks, you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said today that Britain was not aiming for a no-deal Brexit and didn't think that it is where it will end up. But if they can't compromise, if they really can't do it, then clearly we have to get ready for a no-deal exit. Prime Minister Johnson said this during his trip to Wales. He said, it is up to the EU. This is their call. It's their call if they want us to do this. Also, Sinn Féin says Brexit threat means Dublin should prepare for Irish unification. Northern Ireland's largest national party said today they called on the Irish government to prepare for the unification of the British region, with EU member Ireland saying bullish Boris Johnson's Brexit posed a threat. What does this mean going forward? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel Lazar. Daniel, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So Johnson says, quote, the more the UK prepares for a no-deal Brexit, the less likely it is there will be difficulties. He said, adding that it was up to the European Union to determine the fate of Brexit. Quote, the ball is in your court, he said. Now, he vowed to take Britain out of the EU, no ifs, ands, or buts, on October 31st, deal or no deal. Now, he's known as a guy who can say some reckless and outlandish things. Does this or do these comments fit into that category?
Yes, they do. I mean, he is he's playing a game of chicken with the EU. He's convinced that they will blink first. They will agree to some kind of last minute compromise that will prevent a hard Brexit. In other words, Brexit with no deal, and therefore a unilateral move by the UK. It's possible to work. Playing chicken works sometimes, but it's a very risky strategy. And if he's wrong, and I think he probably is wrong, the results could be very dangerous.
Apparently, with all of this turmoil and uncertainty, it's impacting the British pound. It fell down to $1.21 to the pound today. And the prime minister said that the UK government would not offer to comment. Is this game of chicken that he's playing reverberating within the British economy?
Oh, yeah, the British economy and the British polity as well. I mean, Britain is facing a breakup. It's astonishing. I mean, the United Kingdom has existed since the early 18th century, when Scotland and England joined to form a common polity or common kingdom. And it's the kingdom, the political unit that gave us the Industrial Revolution, parliamentary democracy, and classic liberalism, and now it's falling apart before our very eyes. I mean, both Northern Ireland and Scotland voted heavily against Brexit. So therefore, if Brexit goes through, and especially if a hard Brexit goes through, the centrifugal pressures will intensify, and both those regions, both those countries really, will be under greater and greater pressure to pull away. And Northern Ireland will be under pressure to join the Irish Republic in an all-Irish, all-Ireland republic. And I don't know what Scotland would do, but Scotland could conceivably break off as well.
To your point about Ireland, Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou McDonald told supporters in Belfast that Johnson was, quote, not my prime minister, end quote. Her comments come days after Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar said the question of the unification of Ireland and British-ruled Northern Ireland would arise if Britain leaves the EU without a divorce deal on October 31.
Yeah, I mean, 55% of Northern Ireland voted to stay in the EU. So 55% do not want to follow the UK out of the EU. That means that they want to stay put, essentially means that they would join the Irish Republic. Now, I mean, it's not as simple as that, but certainly it does sort of indicate the incredible pressures that are building up, and the fact that the UK structure is disintegrating before our very eyes.
We saw, if we go back to, I guess it was the late 60s through the 70s, we saw some very, very violent battles, yep. Some very violent, the troubles, as they were called, between yes. Northern and Southern Ireland. So does a discussion of reunification bring about concerns that those conflicts will resurface?
Oh, yes, very, very much so. I mean, since 2005, the Irish Northern Ireland border has ceased to exist, essentially. I mean, there's no border there, and people drive back and forth, across it constantly. You know, the Wall Street Journal had an article a few months ago about a business in Northern Ireland, which has operations on both sides of the border, and its trucks and employees shuttled back and forth as easily as someone would between, say, New Jersey and New York. But if that border becomes hard, as it surely will, if there's a hard Brexit, that means there'll be border guards and stops to examine papers, and there will be checks, and goods will not flow back and forth as freely. And that means that the Catholic community of Northern Ireland will be cut off from the Irish Republic, which means that they will feel that they are at the mercy of the Protestant community in the north. And that just can't help but reawaken old tensions, which had become moot. I mean, it's very much like the breakup of Yugoslavia. I mean, under Tito, differences between Serbs and Croats didn't really matter very much.
Mm-hmm.
But after the breakup of Yugoslavia, suddenly they mattered a great, great deal. And soon people were killing one another over those differences. So certainly is every reason to be concerned that the troubles in Northern Ireland will return as a consequence of a hard Brexit.
You made the comment that Boris Johnson is playing a very, very dangerous game of chicken. And there have been a lot of comments that Boris Johnson, in many regards, is very similar to Donald Trump. And Donald Trump seems to play very, very dangerous games of chicken with both domestic policy as well as foreign policy. So do you see Boris Johnson here being Trump-like or Trump-esque?
Very much so. But there's a big difference, one key difference. That is that Trump is a powerful guy, and Johnson is very weak at this point. I mean, Britain is torn between the EU and the U.S., and it doesn't, it's sort of caught in between two giant boulders, and it doesn't know which way to go. for example, when Britain did America's bidding by
seizing the ships,
custody, right, an Iranian, seizing the ships off Gibraltar on July 4th. I mean, it got itself in big trouble, and the U.S. has not come to its rescue. So therefore, the U.K. is left twisting slowly, slowly in the wind. So Johnson is a weak Trump. I mean, Trump can play the game of chicken and maybe sometimes usually get away with it. But with Johnson, it's a lot harder to pull off.
But if he is able to pull this off, then does that change the perception of him and strengthen his hand? We got a minute.
Yes, of course. I mean, if he pulls it off, if the EU blinks, then Johnson will come through with his power greatly enhanced. You know, he'll be hailed as a latter-day Churchill and all the rest of that guff. But it's just as highly unlikely because the EU does not have a motive to compromise, because if the EU compromises with the UK, then it'll be forced to compromise with other dissidents elsewhere on the continent.
And just quickly, to the UK, you can't compromise from positions of weakness. That's called capitulation. You compromise from positions of strength, and Britain really isn't offering much.
Right. And if the EU capitulates to Britain, it'll capitulate to to Salvini and Italy, to a Marine Le Pen in France, and so on, ad infinitum, and the Federation will wind up being greatly weakened.
There we go.
So that's why it's forced to adopt a hard line.
Daniel Lazar, as always, thanks for your time. Appreciate your wonderful analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened, and I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.